Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Edward Isaac Devere's new book, Battle for the Soul, offers new details on the soul searching that went on in the Democratic Party after the unexpected 2016 loss to Donald Trump, as well as insights on the personalities and the race to regain the White House in 2020. Among the revelations are new details in Barack Obama's shadow opposition to the Trump administration and how he counseled a number of presidential contenders in the run-up to the primaries, how close Jim Clyburn of South Carolina was to not endorsing Joe Biden in the pivotal state of South Carolina, as well as how Biden overcame his anger at Kamala Harris's attacks on the former vice president during the primaries to choose her for his running mate, and who were the other serious contenders. Many aspects of the books have been in the news lately, and Devere joins us to discuss some of his reporting. Edward Isaac Devere is a staff writer for The Atlantic and its lead political correspondent. He's covered Democratic politics for 15 years, and he's worked the Obama White House and, of course, across 29 states during the 2020 election cycle. His reporting has won the White House Correspondent Association's Merriman Smith Award for Excellence and the Society of Professional Journalists Daniel Pearl Award for Investigative Reporting. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Edward Isaac Devere, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The story you tell about the 2020 campaign really begins on election night 2016. Of course, any party that loses the White House along with Congress is somewhat bereft, but the picture you paint is especially bleak. How bad was it for the Democratic Party in November and December of 2016?
Well, it was really bad. Look, pretty much everybody who was watching the 2016 election expected Donald Trump to lose. That includes, by the way, Donald Trump. And the book starts with Barack Obama and Joe Biden watching Trump win. Barack Obama at the White House and Joe Biden at the vice president's residence at the Naval Observatory in Washington. And going through the process of realizing this is real, he's won, and what it's going to start to mean, although they don't fully process it even that night and the weeks following. But they're going through a realization process that is similar to what was going on in the country and certainly within the Democratic Party of thinking, what does this mean now? For the Democrats, though, it was not just that it was a surprise that Donald Trump won. It was a surprise that the Senate elections and House elections didn't go as well as they thought. They went into election night 2016 thinking that they might win the Senate, and that is not at all what happened. What that did on top of it is, and that was almost, that was more than enough to scramble their brains. But there was then, looking at the situation that they had, a fuller examination of the state of the Democratic Party that realized just how bad things were, just what a level of decimation there was up and down the ballot across the country. One of the numbers that captures this is that there were about 1,000 seats in state legislatures around the country that were held by Democrats when Barack Obama came in 2008 that were held by Republicans by the time he finished. That's a massive change. And of course, when he came in, the House and the Senate were under Democratic control. By the time he left, they're under Republican control, and Donald Trump's the president. So it is a true existential crisis. It's a true political crisis for the Democratic Party. And it is for Democratic leaders at the beginning of the Trump era, it's thinking maybe politics has changed completely. We need to make deals with Trump in every which way we can and move toward his kind of politics. Of course, at that point, it wasn't clear what Donald Trump's politics were going to be. And there was a sense among a number of Democratic leaders like, oh, he's a deal maker. He won't be very partisan. He'll be sort of post-partisan, and we can figure out things like that. That's not the presidency that we got out of Trump.
Yeah, very quickly, they had to learn that they had to go to complete opposition, much like the Republicans did in 2009.
That was part of it. And again, there was the sense that Trump was going to work with Democrats, that there was going to be, remember, infrastructure, which, of course, we're talking about again with the Biden presidency. But when Trump, shortly after Election Day, they started talking, we're going to make a big post-partisan, cross-partisan infrastructure deal. It'll have all sorts of things in it that Democrats will like and Republicans will like. That never came to be, but that became the symbol of the kind of presidency that Trump came in sort of promising right after he was elected and never did. Instead, they moved toward right away, quickly trying to repeal Obamacare and doing things that sent the Democrats into full opposition mode. But of course, even with repealing Obamacare, the Democrats were so scrambled by the 2016 results that there were a number of them who were saying, that's it, Obamacare is done. It'll be gone within a couple of months. And the grassroots efforts, more than anything, about Obamacare was what stopped that from happening.
And that's really where the rebuilding of the Democratic Party began after the 2016 election. And that is not complete by any stretch of the imagination. When you look at the 2020 results, that weakness that has been in the Democratic Party over the Obama years, for better or ill, maybe the President Obama had better things to do with his presidency. What he didn't do was spend time working on the Democratic Party organization. Do you think that work is still continuing today?
Oh, it's definitely still continuing. You see, even once again, in November of last year, Democrats went into Election Day thinking that it was going to be much better for them. They thought that they would win a couple of Senate races that they didn't win. They were at one point expecting to expand their majority in the House. Instead, their majority shrunk in the House because they lost races that they were not anticipating having to worry about. And that's because this is a long process that is not complete and may never get completed of the Democrats building themselves back up. But a lot of it does root back to what happened when Obama was president. He was the leader of the party for 8 years, and there were a number of things that he did that people can be very proud of if they like him. And then there are a number of things when you look at his record and you say, however you think of him, this is a problem for the Democratic Party. The lack of investment in Democratic Party infrastructure is something that people around Obama referred to me as benign neglect, to not really care about who was running the Democratic National Committee, to not really care about what was going on there and party building efforts around the country. The Obama reelection campaign saddled the DNC with millions of dollars in debt, and he was focused on other things. He didn't think that that's where he needed to have his emphasis. He was focused on things that he thought were more important about the presidency than about building the Democratic Party. And there was certainly an effect of that over time.
So you write about Joe Biden's decision not to run in 2016 and how he was grieving for his son and all the issues that went into that decision. How unlikely a candidate was Joe Biden in after 2016, even in the early days of the Trump presidency? Can you share how that decision-making that Joe Biden decided to run in 2020?
Well, as I report in the book, on election night 2016, Biden gets a call. He's on the phone with the mayor of Detroit, who is a friend of his. He's checking in about the Michigan results. Remember, Michigan ends up going by just 10,704 votes to Trump, very narrow margin, and Biden is trying to figure it out. And the mayor says to him that Trump is going to win Michigan. That's it. And Biden's reaction is, oh, Lord. The mayor says to him, I just want to be the first person to sign on to the Joe Biden 2020 campaign. And Biden is very noncommittal about it. Doesn't really say, like, yes or no. And Biden then, over the next couple of months, is in this process of trying to sort out what to do. I did an interview with him in his office in the West Wing, in his vice presidential office, about a week before Trump's inauguration. And he started talking about what Democrats need to do to reconnect with people that they'd lost. And he's going on about this. And I said to him, that sounds like a stump speech. And he says, no, it's not a stump speech. Well, maybe it's a stump speech for someone else, but not for me. He wanted to be president of the United States for a long time, but he knew that it was unlikely, that he was already at that point older than anybody who had been elected president ever, that there were a lot of things that potentially were working against him to be president. And he starts toying with it with people. He says, if I'm walking, I'm running. I was then at a speech that he gave in Manchester, New Hampshire in April of 2017, the first speech he gave in his post-vice presidential life in New Hampshire. It was a little on the nose. And I was there, and I had written a story that was published that morning about how a presidential campaign might work if it came together. And Biden looks at the back of the room where the reporters are, and he says, guys, I'm not running, okay? but it continues, and he's toying with it. And then Charlottesville happens in August of 2017. And that is the seminal moment that changes everything for Joe Biden. It's the reason why he continues to talk about it throughout his campaign for president. Because what what he saw then was not that Donald Trump was to him anathema in policy or bad for politics. It was something more fundamental than that. It was something about the core of America to him. And he began to say that there is absolutely no way that we can allow Trump to be the president for four more years. And Biden's formulation, and it's a little bit self-serving as politicians can tend to be, is that he says he needs to lose. If I'm convinced that somebody else can beat him, I won't run. But if I'm not, then I'm going to run. And that's where he is by the end of 2017. Of course, there's then another year and a half or so of him sorting around the pieces, and he's telling people, well, I'm 20% there, I'm 40% there, by the end of 70% there, I'm 90% there, until he finally announces. It all tracks back to Charlottesville, and the essay that he wrote after Charlottesville is he talks about it being a battle for the soul of the nation. And that's the name of the book that I wrote, obviously, Battle for the Soul. And when I spoke to Biden at the beginning of February for this book, and the interview that the book ends with, he's 2 weeks into being president. And I said to him, so, Mr. President, I should tell you the title of the book is going to be Battle for the Soul. And he says to me, well, you know, the difference between you and me, pal, is I actually believe it. and he didn't mean it to be jerky. He has a sarcastic sense of humor. But I said to him, you know, actually, I think you turned out to be right. Whatever you think of Biden and Trump and the politics of the last few years, it is America really sorting out fundamental questions about what's going on and what we want to be as a country. And in some ways, it's a battle for the soul. But everything that was going on in the Democratic Party that I track in this book, everything that was going on for the country, then going into the general election, all these things that were in the balance, by the way, accentuated by the pandemic and the economic crisis and then the racial reckoning that the country's been going through since George Floyd over the last year. All of that is what we are living through here.
My guest today is Edward Isaac DeVere, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and his new book is titled Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaign to Defeat Trump. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, there's another main character that is taking place during the Trump presidency, is how President Obama reacted to the Trump win in 2016. You write of Obama's sadness and anger in the first part of the Trump presidency, and then his very behind-the-scenes maneuvering as sort of a shadow opposition through the Trump presidency and maneuvering in the run-up to the next presidential election. Tell us about this shadow opposition, if you would.
There was a sense that people had of Barack Obama as completely detached and watching what was going on from afar as if he didn't care. He cared about what was happening. He was very upset by the Trump presidency and very disappointed in Trump, even though he didn't have high expectations going in. It got much worse for him and very quickly changed. There's a line in the book from his close advisor, Ben Rhodes, who says that part of what happened is that shortly after Trump's win, it makes Obama think that the country is actually more racist and has to confront the racism of the country more than he had considered. And Rhodes says he was like Jackie Robinson. He always knew the hecklers were there, but he was able to ignore them, and he couldn't ignore it anymore. And Obama goes through this process over the Trump years that I think tracks with where a lot of Democrats were and where a lot of the country was, of starting out thinking, okay, like, crazy the Trump won, and then, okay, well, it's not going to be that bad. And then thinking, okay, this is getting really intense. And by the end, by the time that he's campaigning for Biden in the fall of 2020, it's just ripping into him in every which way, saying he's got to go, crisis for everything, we've got to be all on in there. But along the way, the role that he is playing for a lot of Democrats, for a lot of Democratic politicians, is this quiet mentor, in some ways even up to like therapist level for Joe Biden, talking to him through the campaign. And he is also reacting to what he's seeing in the news from Trump constantly. Sometimes he is just saying it to staff, and sometimes it's donors to the foundation that he's been getting up and running who are saying, hey, like, tell us what you think about Trump. Come on, tell us a little bit. And he tries to push it off, and then he says things like, I didn't think it would be this bad. Or then the language gets more intense sometimes when he hears that Trump is talking to foreign leaders without aides on the calls, and when he's inviting the Russian ambassador into the Oval Office and having private meetings there, nobody knows what goes on there. He refers to him as a corrupt MFR. He does not use MFR, he uses the full word. But we'll keep the censors off your back, Rich.
Thanks.
And there's a lot of other language like that, cursing, that, yes, it's okay, it's funny that the former president is cursing behind the scenes, but I actually think it's what the cursing reflects of just how upset he was about what was going on. And the other thing that you see happening is him quietly having a presence with the primary campaign candidates, talking to them throughout, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, all of them he's in conversation with, and playing an important role at the end of the primary campaign for each of the candidates, but also for when it was really the end of the campaign, and it was Sanders and Biden figuring out how the Democrats perhaps get to a better place in unity than they were in 2016. And Obama was instrumental in that.
Yeah, he also had some interesting notions, too. At one point, he was touting Bill McRaven for president in 2020, who, you know, most people probably don't even know who Bill McRaven was. He was the admiral who had been in charge of the raid that killed bin Laden. That seems like a little off-the-wall notion.
It was not just an idea that he had. There were a couple of Democrats who were into the idea of McRaven as sort of a Cincinnatus figure who had come in, right, was not political, but would be the one to heal the country. As you mentioned, was the commander of the raid that killed bin Laden, a very respected admiral. And there's a scene in the book where in December of 2017, we're about a year into the Trump presidency, and Obama was playing the kind of game that a lot of people were, but certainly a lot of Democrats were, already saying, who do you think could run? And he's on a plane with some of his aides. And he says, okay, so who do you think in your head you want to run? Who do you think with your heart you want to run? And who do you think can win? And as he said, Obama says McRaven for his head. He says Joe Biden for his heart. He loves Joe Biden. As for who could win, he says, I'm not really sure. And he talks about other things, a couple of NBA coaches that Greg Popovich was on his list saying, you know, this is a guy, he's like that was going around and on Twitter, and I was like, oh, Popovich for president. He says, look, they obviously get how to work with people of different races, and they've got leadership skills, and maybe there's something to that, but he's never really serious about it. But the one, it's always that Biden is occupying a prime place for him. But he is throughout, starting in those early days in 2017, and even through last fall, skeptical to different degrees of Biden's ability to win, to connect with people enough to make a campaign happen. And you see that evolution happen in Obama throughout the book of wondering, can he do it, to then saying, okay, he is doing it, and how can I help a little bit, and then helping Biden bring the party together after the primary campaigns are done, and all the way through then campaigning for him in full force into the fall.
You write that Obama said he was, quote, rusty. God knows how rusty Joe is. And that statement seemed pretty prescient. You know, Biden seemed to have trouble connecting with voters in the early days of the campaign. And of course, you write that at one point before the big endorsement in South Carolina, you know, they were racking up debt. They were charging reporters for food of covering the campaign. How close did he come to closing up shop?
He came very close at a number of points to the campaign just completely coming off the rails. I was covering the campaign day to day. We could see it. It's hard to really put yourself back into it now because he's the president of the United States. And it worked out for him in the end, obviously. But when you go back to really just before things started working out for him with the South Carolina primaries, where things changed very quickly, and the chapter in the book is called 72 Hours That Changed History. Yeah. Remember, South Carolina, that primary is Saturday. Super Tuesday is 3 days later. And in that period is when Joe Biden turns this all around and essentially becomes the nominee. But all through 2019, he was struggling. The campaign was short on money. Biden was stumbling on the stump. He was saying things that were getting him into trouble, that nobody was showing up to events. I would go to events in Iowa that there was one event I remember I went to. It was his second trip to Iowa, and it was in June of 2019. And we went to a town called Ottumwa. There's a theater there that seats about 800 people. And we walked into the theater, and there were some chairs set up in a hallway outside the theater. And I thought, oh, okay, that's for the reporters beforehand to give us space to work and type our stories up. And then it became clear to me that, no, that's the space that they had set aside for the people attending this event, because they knew that they couldn't fill the theater. And so they had the event in a hallway outside of the theater and had about 200 people show. The campaign was very excited because they'd only set out 80 chairs. And so having that kind of showing, that's when the former vice president of the United States was leading in the polls all at the beginning of the campaign, and there just wasn't that energy for him. He got better over the course of the campaign, really into the general election campaign. It was a primary campaign that really wasn't working in a lot of ways. And I saw him the moment of the book, the night before the South Carolina primary, where it's so weird to think about because it was a rope line where he didn't have Secret Service on him yet. And it was right before the pandemic hit. So there was no social distance, anything. People were crowded up. And I was right there next to him, listening to the conversations that he was having with people. And he saw me, and I said to him, we all knew that South Carolina was going to go pretty well for him. And I said, so how does it feel to be winning an election for once? And he said to me, well, I don't want to jinx it just yet. But it was a campaign that was, it was not luck, but it was a lot of things that came together in this kaleidoscope of ways to make him the candidate in the end for the Democrats. And then you see a moment emerge with the coronavirus and with everything that brought on the economy, and obviously with the George Floyd situation, that was not there at the beginning of the campaign, wasn't there at the beginning of the primary campaign or at the beginning of the general election campaign. And now the presidency that Biden is having is certainly not the presidency that he thought he was going to have going into this race. And I talked to him about that for the interview as president, that's in the book, having him reflect on what it is that's now ahead of him and how he thinks about it.
I just want to mention one other thing about South Carolina was that you reveal in the book that the endorsement of Jim Clyburn, which was considered so transformative, almost didn't happen. Clyburn was considering other candidates. Tell us a little about that reporting.
Well, that endorsement was, as you say, transformative. It was a major moment in the campaign and helped Biden have as definitive a win in South Carolina as he did, got 50% of the vote. Bernie Sanders was far back and he was in second place and all the other candidates were nowhere near it. And so that's why it very quickly changed going into Super Tuesday. But Clyburn, he liked Biden. He thought Biden was the best candidate to beat Trump. He had a personal connection to him. He wanted to endorse Biden. He was a little concerned that Biden's campaign was going so badly. Remember, in the run-up to South Carolina, Biden comes in fourth in Iowa, and then he follows that up by coming in fifth in New Hampshire. That's not the recipe for a winning campaign, usually. But that's where things were. He came in second in Nevada, and that was enough to get people thinking, like, okay, maybe there's some way for this to work. He was a distant second to Bernie Sanders in Nevada, way back. But that was enough for Clyburn to see that there was space there to maybe help him out and lift him up, which is what he did. But in that period, there was some consideration, okay, if it's not going to be Biden, if he can't get there, who else could maybe get there? And the hope was Clyburn's determination, essentially, was that Bernie Sanders not be the nominee because he didn't think Sanders could win.
Yeah, and he was thinking maybe Michael Bloomberg instead, which today it seems like, did Michael Bloomberg even run for president? But of course he did, and he spent a lot of money for a short amount of time, and then he stiffed a lot of people afterwards.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that Bloomberg campaign, it definitely happened, and it was there was a moment at the end of January as Biden was really faltering when it seemed like maybe this could be the real way things went. The chapter in the book about the Bloomberg campaign is called $1 billion for Samoa, because he spent $1 billion on the campaign, and the only primary he won was in American Samoa. Yeah. But you see, the reason why the Bloomberg campaign, yes, I think you're right, you can sort of forget that it happened, but it's a chapter in the book because it captures, I think, a lot of what was happening in the primary process at that point, and the panic that a lot of people had about all the things that were going on in the party.
You quoted a donor, a Biden donor, who acknowledged towards the end of the book that Biden would be transitional, not transformative. It seems as though the President Biden is challenging that statement. What struck you most about the way President Biden has governed so far?
Yeah, and that donor was speaking to me at the end of 2019, when things were going really badly for Biden, saying, just hold on, hold on. He could, just don't count him out. He can be the one to beat Trump. That's enough. Biden is running a presidency, as I said, that he couldn't have expected, and thinking about things now in a way that is bigger and more seizing of opportunities because of the crises that the country is presented with than anybody would have guessed. There was this sense that he would come in and be the deal maker and just compromise on everything. That's not what we've seen so far. We've seen a president who is very determined to leave a mark in his presidency, through his presidency on the country. I read in the book that in talking with him, it's clear that he knows his presidency is a function in part of Barack Obama, Obama picking his vice president, the connection that Obama inherently gave Biden with black voters, which was essential in the primary campaign for Biden. He knows also that his presidency is a function of Donald Trump, that he was elected in a lot of people's minds just to be the one to get Trump out of the way, and that helped power him through the primary and helped him in the general election too. But he is determined to not let that be his place in history. Biden is the oldest president that we've ever had. We should all hope that he and like everybody else lives and is well for a long time. But actuarially speaking, his post-presidency will probably be shorter than most of the post-presidencies we've seen in recent times. And so there is even an additional emphasis in his mind on getting things done and having a real legacy that he feels like he can finish his presidency with, so whether he is a one-term president or a two-term president, and give something. He thinks a lot in terms of his family, his grandchildren all the time, and that's the way he's thinking, not as the guy who is going to 60 years from now be living in the world that is shaped by this period in America, but who's creating what his grandchildren and their children will be living through.
The name of the book is Battle for the Soul. Isaac DeVere, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Edward Isaac DeVere speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's a staff writer and lead political correspondent for The Atlantic and the author of Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. It's published by Penguin Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Have a great Memorial Day holiday.